And so, as many of you know, I was originally scheduled to talk last Sunday and to have three in a row starting last Sunday, but I had dental surgery 8 days ago. And when we scheduled the dental surgery, which was scheduled just with about 8 or 9 days warning, I was told not to schedule teaching the day after. And I think that was a good idea. But in any case, I'm glad that we could readjust the schedule. We're going to be doing three in a row, and I'm going to be focusing on the theme of deepening daily life practice, and particularly next week and the week after, we'll be focusing on skillful speech when there are difficulties in communication. Sometimes polarization, could be political polarization or differences of views, could be challenges or conflicts. And what I want to do is to talk today, explore today with you the foundations or some of the foundations of daily life practice, and the ones that particularly are very valuable to help us be more skillful in the more complex kind of situations in which we have challenges in our relationships with others, whether it's with one other person or in a group or whatever. And the model, which is one that I generally hold in virtually every form of practice, is that of integrating inner practice with what we might call more outer, more relational practice, being with others, and the power of bringing those two together. And so the three sessions will be very much related, and in a sense will work today and then hopefully in our practice in the next week to develop further the foundations that will help us work with challenges in relationships or groups or communities. And so I don't think I'll ask you to go out and cause a lot of problems so you can have good material for the next 2 weeks. That's up to you. But if you want, if now is the time to deal with a difficult issue that you've put off for 2 years or 30 years, maybe you can explore that. We'll see. Anyway, deepening daily life practice, I thought I could talk all about my surgery, but I won't. I'll be brief on it, though, because there are actually a lot of very powerful, we might say, Dharma themes. You know, I had what I think of as relatively minor surgery, but still it involved general anesthesia. And I had to put my name on a piece of paper that acknowledged the 100 horrible ways that things could go wrong. Remember those? And, you know, and that I would die, that they checked on my advanced directives, all sorts of things. So, you know, and then just being with the surgery, being virtually naked, it definitely brings up a sense of mortality, you know, a sense of, you know, coming into this just with my own body as I was when I was born, without clothes on, very simply. And the other piece, you know, in addition to really just reflecting on mortality, the other piece was that was really powerful for me was the collective kindness of the team that worked for me. I went to Kaiser Richmond, and it was on a Saturday, so I think it was less busy than usual, which had some advantages. I had a team of five people And they were uniformly kind, friendly, compassionate. Some of them in our through our dialogues may go deeper in meditation, for all I know. That's one of the things that can happen in these sort of situations. Another aspect that was very powerful for me was just the of the five people, the ethnic diversity. The surgeon was of Middle Eastern origin, or his ancestry was, a Middle Eastern American. The assistant surgeon, Asian American. Three nurses, one African American, one Mexican American, one European American. That was the team. And they worked incredibly harmoniously together. Beautiful team, connecting with each other, connecting with me. That in itself was powerful and inspiring, right? Very simple model of people coming together across differences which didn't seem to matter in this instance. And so I just wanted to mention, you know, those two aspects related to the surgery. And the surgeon said that that the surgery was 100% successful. Yay. And so 100% successful. Nonetheless, I still have some swelling and some numbness here. The surgery was right around here. And I can't smile properly. So if I seem to smile, I'll have to be careful not tell too many jokes, because I've been told that I smile and laugh at my own jokes, which I've tried to work with that over the years, but it hasn't happened, hadn't changed. Anyway, so if you notice me smiling in a crooked way, you'll know why. Okay, so this theme of Delhi, the foundations for deepening Delhi life practice, and the importance of them when things get more complex relationally or socially. These are the foundations for social healing, actually, if we look to some of the larger issues. These are the foundations for being skillful with responding to climate crisis, to racism, to sexism, to other isms. And so these are capacities that I think are very valuable in themselves for us individually, but the emphasis for these 3 weeks will be bringing them also into our being with others, into our relations with others. And so again, daily life practice is both the crux of our lives, and it's challenging, right? That we get quite busy, even if we're not working. Anyone not working regularly and really, really busy? Yeah, it's interesting how that happens, right? And so how to bring practice. So a few foundations that I think I want to encourage us maybe to see which of them resonate with us and practice, especially with one or two of them in the next week. And then we'll use those as a basis for going into how we work with challenges in relationships, particularly polarization. Of views or attitudes or interests or needs. And I should also say that some of the directions that we're exploring came out of our work in the day long that we did with the Sangha at the beginning of June. And then, as many of you know, we've had a group which has stayed with that material over a number of weeks, and we're actually continuing. We'll have some further meetings, and this is in a way following up from both the day long and connecting with the follow up group. the great Tibetan teacher Shabkar, let your life and practice be one. But how to do that? So a few areas that I'll name. One is finding ways to have supports for daily life practice. You know, practice in the flow of our daily lives. And we could name many, many supports. Being here tonight is a support. Having regular formal practice is a support. Especially finding a few times, or maybe just one or two times during the day, where you come back, in a sense, to practice, where you have pauses. Maybe it's a second formal sitting. Maybe it's a time during the day where you always take a walk. Maybe it's one meal a day where you eat in silence. Maybe it's something else. I think I've mentioned to you that I, these days, do lap swimming 4 or 5 times a week. And in my lap swimming, I do metta practice. One lap per person, right? And I generally have found recently, I've been doing it when my right arm comes down, I go to another quality that I wish for the person. So it gets rhythmic and it's quite quite wonderful. And it's becomes a routine where if I'm not doing it, it feels weird. That's what we want. We want one or two things like that during the day where there's so much a habit or a routine that if we don't do them, it feels weird and we generally correct ourselves. So finding practices like that, it could be a Sabbath practice once a week, not to do all these, but just see what are the one or two ways that you can take your own practice a little bit further, a little bit deeper. That's all you need. Make it very personal. What calls me? You know, there can be all sorts of things. One emphasis that we focused on in the day long, which is very crucial, is mindfulness of the body. In a very cerebral culture where we're online a lot, where we're especially in a more conceptual mode, mindfulness of the body is so crucial, and it's really, really powerful relationally. It's one of the ways we can stay present with others. We can be with others, be present to our bodies. Even, you know, one of the practices is, that's not easy, is keeping inner and outer awareness at the same time when you're in conversation. You can do that when you're listening. It's easier when you're listening, like right now. Be aware in some way of your body. Could be 20% of the attention on the hands, the feet, connection with the chair or cushion. And see if you can keep it there. And when we can bring this into speech practice, it makes a huge difference. So we're not in that automatic mind. We're not in the mode of just being and thinking or being away from our bodies. The great Thai forest tradition teacher Achan Mun said, in all of your investigations, never lose contact with the body. And so we can do that in different ways. We can do that when we're listening to the radio or television, have some connection with the body. On the telephone, have some awareness of the body. Also, you know, multiple ways, you know, we could do a whole day long on mindfulness of the body, all sorts of ways to do that. Take a walk, you know, in all your walking, be aware of the body, while cooking or while washing the dishes and so forth. So find ways that we can be more in our bodies. And can also do it in formal meditation. You know, I've sometimes mentioned how for me, actually when I started meditation, being aware of my body was a revelation. because I was pretty much in my mind all the time, even though I'd been very physical in my life. And meditation was a coming back to the body, you know, in many ways. But even though that was the case, I don't know, 20 plus years after I started meditating, I had another important cycle where in formal meditation, I was aware of the whole body. And I did that for most of the meditations for 4 years, right? And that played a big role. It made it possible for mindfulness of the whole body to become available just with intent, just with one moment intention. It got so wired into awareness. And you don't have to do it for 4 years to have it make a difference. But mindfulness of the whole body is something we can do in formal meditation that really transfers into daily life, into walking, into being with others, especially. I can invite that now as I'm teaching. I don't always remember, but with the practice, the awareness is just a intention away, a moment away. So mindfulness of the body, so crucial to work with that in different ways. You know, a second major foundation that we looked at a little bit in the formal meditation just now is practicing with reactivity, noticing times when we either grasp onto something or push away something. And I think I'll go back to a core teaching now that I think I've offered quite a number of times here, but it's helpful to revisit it because this is really the teaching that gives us a clear understanding of what reactivity is. So let's use that slide now, Corey. This is going to the teaching on dependent origination. And this is the sequence that's probably very familiar to most of us. In the middle of the 12 links of dependent origination. Dependent origination, again, is the teaching which really makes it clear how dukkha or suffering occurs based on ignorance. But this is the crucial section. In our experience, in any given experience, there's some kind of contact of one or more of the senses, and that includes thinking, with what we might call a sense object. So I see something, I hear something, I think something, I feel or touch something, I smell or taste something. And that is, at this point, relatively neutral. It leads invariably, which means always, it leads to what's called feeling tone. In other words, every moment of experience, me hearing something, seeing something, thinking something, has a sense of being either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, of which maybe 98 or 99 plus percent are neutral. Very few are pleasant or unpleasant. There's a spectrum, so something can be more or less in a neutral zone. And this is where things get interesting, and this is where our practice comes in. And a lot of our practice can be focused on looking out for when there's a moderate or stronger sense of pleasant or unpleasant, because the teaching is that when we're not mindful and we have a lot of habits, when a pleasant experience occurs, we tend to want it, either to want more of it or want it in the future, want it to continue. And then we grasp after it. You know, I like the taste of that dessert. I want more. I may not even be conscious of it. And I without even often knowing it, I take a second piece. Right? That's when there's not mindfulness. You know, and sometimes there could be mindfulness, and I know what's happening, and I still might choose to have the second piece. So this is not about being overly ascetic. working with this teaching can still be coexistent with taking second pieces of dessert, just for clarification's sake. I don't think the Buddha talked about that particular example, but just to be clear. Okay. And in a similar way, when we're not aware of the unpleasant, we will tend to go into not wanting it and then pushing it away in some manner or other. And often we go from 2 to 4 in a split second, right? And I don't even know that it's unpleasant. I don't even know that I don't like it or don't want it. And I often don't even know that I'm being reactive in the sense of pushing away. So I'm talking about reactivity as number 4, grasping or pushing away. 2 forms that we want to look at. So our practice can occur in a number of different ways. We can set our radar to notice when there's reactivity, when number 4 occurs, and we can look for it. Again, we can notice all the different ways that reactivity occurs. It can occur at the level of the body. I can tense around something unpleasant, right? Or I can, again, want a pleasant taste. I can want more. I can grasp. And again, a lot of this is happening so quickly and habitually. We go from 1 to 4 in a split second, right? Very, very, very quickly. Whether it's at the level of the body or the level of the emotions, I'm feeling angry and I become reactive towards myself or towards another person. Or it can happen at the level of the mind. I don't like what someone said, or I don't like a particular idea. You know, maybe I'm really upset about all the anti-vaxxers. I hear an anti-vax idea and I get really reactive towards it. That could be an example. And so different ways to practice with reactivity. And I think we can let go of the slide now, Corey. Thanks so much. So different ways to practice with reactivity. One way is to keep on cultivating forms of non-reactivity. Really crucial. Mindfulness is a form of non-reactivity. Mindfulness of reactivity is not reactive. So cultivate mindfulness, a sense of balance in being with phenomena, cultivate more equanimity. Equanimity is really about non-reactivity. You know, so cultivate non-reactivity. Secondly, when reactivity occurs, explore it. See what it's about. Ultimately, we want to really be experts on our 5 or 10 main forms of reactivity. See them clearly, make a list of them, put them on our refrigerator, and look out for them. Have our radar, and if you want to work with this in the next week, know what your forms of reactivity are and look out for them. And this individual work with reactivity is clearly so crucial in the context of relational challenges, right? That a lot of what happens that makes relationships or groups or communities difficult is that one or both or many parties become reactive. And what do we do when we're reactive? The technical term is we have a mess, right? Or we have get involved with some kind of reactive pattern. You know, I've noticed for myself and for others, so many of the dysfunctional individual relationships as well as group relationships are just about patterns of one action leading to reactivity in the other person and back and forth, right? That probably how many people are quite familiar with those patterns. You know, one person's reactive, the second is, and it goes just on and on like that. Same thing with Most conflicts that are stuck follow that pattern. And so we can see that individual work with our own reactivity in a given context becomes crucial for being in relational and social settings. Again, the model of both skillful inner work and skillful outer response. That's the model that I'm suggesting this week, and then also in the next 2 weeks. You know, we'll work more on those relational and social contexts in the next 2 weeks, particularly speech and communication. And so we can develop non-reactivity further. We can really study our own reactivity, look at it. Very interesting practice is to go back and see if we can pay particular attention to how we relate to the pleasant and unpleasant. So a very skillful practice would be to have, be alert in sitting meditation, for example, for times when there's a moderate or stronger sense of pleasant or a moderate or stronger sense of unpleasant, and then just watch what happens. That can be really, really fruitful. You know, we would call this Vedana practice, the practice of being with the feeling tone, and watch, you know, if there are tendencies to go to reactivity. You know, interpersonally, this is why some of you probably know the technique of saying when something is said that feels painful, saying ouch. How many of you sometimes do this in your interactions? That can be very skillful. Say ouch. It's actually Vedana practice. It's actually noticing the feeling tone and knowing from the teaching that when there's a significantly strong, unpleasant experience, in this case, there'll be a tendency to reactivity. So we can actually study that sequence of pleasant to grasping and unpleasant to pushing away. We can also sometimes, when we notice ourselves reactive, go back and ask, where is the pleasant or unpleasant experience? I suddenly notice myself reactive, and we can sometimes go back. Okay, what is the reaction based on? You know, so if I'm, you know, if I notice myself in an interaction getting very reactive, I don't always know what the trigger was. But I can, especially if I take a time out or maybe later in the day, I can ask, what was that trigger? What was going on? What was unpleasant there? And we can come to know, sometimes these are my five main triggers. These are my five main ways I become reactive. And I think the last thing I want to talk about is something that we've looked at here on Sunday nights. We also looked at it in the day long. And that's the theme of what I've called doing and not doing. And that has importance also in relationship to being skillful with relational or social challenges, conflicts, difficulties. We can think about it and look at it in a few different ways. And some of you may remember some of the themes that I looked at when I explored the theme of doing and not doing, that a really important aspect here is looking at my own patterns in terms of, am I more of an active doer or am I more receptive? How do I balance those qualities? We can look at this in terms of formal meditation, as well as how we are with others. And part of the process here is just to inquire, what are my patterns? What are my patterns in terms of, on the one hand, being more active, on the other hand, being more receptive? And you may remember that in terms of formal meditation, the balance of those two is really important. And I pointed to that in the instructions by talking about looking for a balance of alertness and ease. That's one way it could get expressed. But that in meditation, there's a very important role for being active, for doing things, for noticing what's occurring, maybe naming what's occurring with our mindfulness, asking oneself, what's a skillful response right now? Bringing the practice into daily life, having intentions to be mindful, be aware, very central role for doing, for being active in meditation and daily life. You know, we may also look and see that often in my relations with others, maybe I'm really active in my speaking and communication. Maybe I'm more active than I am receptive. But in both in meditation and daily life and in being with others, the receptive is also really, really crucial. So we want to, in meditation, have the ability just to be with the flow of experience, to allow experience to occur, to be with the flow of emotions, not to be overly controlling of experience. Some of us have tendencies to really control or want to be in charge of experience. And so I know that was some of my learning initially very much. Can I let go? You know, for me, it was partly letting go of thinking, just to know what's happening and just to open up to the unknown flow of experience, open up to the mystery of experience, a really key part of our practice. And so that receptive dimension is really crucial. Can I just be with the flow of body sensations without trying to do anything? Can I be with the flow of thoughts and just sit back and watch them? When there is a difficult emotion, maybe anger or sadness, can I just give myself up to the emotion and be with it? Not always easy, but it can be very, very powerful. It also, when we're receptive like this, it also opens up often to what's deeper, to what's beneath a particular emotion or a particular thought. Can I just invite that receptivity? So we look for the balance. And again, that balance can really be noticed in relationships and interactions, and I think is a crucial practice. In my communications, am I more the active one or more the receptive one? You know, and a lot of this can be very much tied to gender conditioning, as I think we've explored at times, right? No coincidence that 75% of receptive therapists or therapists who need to have the receptivity well-developed, 75% are women. And we could go into that, this theme, in a lot of depth if we wanted to. And so where am I? How am I in terms of being with others, being in groups, being in communities? How do I balance being active and being receptive? Which of those might be skillful to emphasize more? Do I hold back? Am I more receptive partly because I don't want to go to places? Also could be that I am active in some ways, but not in others. Maybe I'm active with a lot of thoughts, but less bringing forward maybe my emotions, right? So looking at that balance becomes really crucial in looking at relational challenges or challenges in communities or socially, looking at that balance. And then another piece that we have looked at when we look at the theme of doing and not doing is actually going a little further to see if there's a kind of identity of oneself as a doer. You know, investigating the doer. When do I get nervous when I'm not doing anything? When I have some open time, maybe, or I'm on vacation, or I have a day that's not scheduled. Do I have compulsion to be a doer, so to speak? We can look at that, and that there's a lot of conditioning for many of us around always doing something. And so we can look into that sense of identity as a doer, or maybe the identity as the one who does in a certain way. I'm the smart one. I'm the together one. So this dimension of investigation brings us into what we might call some of the structures of self, some of the structures and images of self. So it gets into that investigation of anatta or not self, and can become very, very interesting, because I think these patterns are quite deep in the culture and in so many of us. And so, yeah, so that's something also to look at in the context of challenging situations. What do I do when there's a challenging situation? Do I try to take control? Do I allow the other person to speak? Do I want to have my view imposed on the situation? Do I have a more collaborative approach in which there's collaborative doing, as it were, or is my doing very much self-centered? So there's a lot to look at here. I think the sense of, as it were, being a doer is very, very strong, I think, in this culture. And maybe I'll move towards closing. There are some other themes that we've explored with doing and not doing. You may remember I've sometimes brought in Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu and other passages which point to the possibility of a doing which comes out of a kind of non-doing, which is more spontaneous and less about control, and can be a beautiful model of how to work with challenging situations. You know, can I relax into a challenging situation? I was thinking of something for me that just happened a few hours ago, where I was talking about actual payment for some teaching where they don't operate on a Donna basis. And we hadn't really clarified things completely before the actual teaching occurred. And there was some awkwardness to talk about this. You know, I know the person well, and I'm very important to keep a good relationship. And so I try to go into that situation more with a sense of flow and being open to what developed as much as I could. And it actually worked out really, really well. But there was a sense really of being light on the doing as much as I could, or light on what my view might be. And it actually worked out well. So there's a lot here that we can bring in. So maybe that, what would it be like to be in a conflict and approach it more as a collaborative dance? That's not about fixated me over here, fixated you over there, where we've cut through some of our more habituated senses of identity. So the doing and not doing emphasis can help us really to explore that, so that our being with others, including in difficult moments, becomes more like that collaborative dance, or maybe like the discipline of authentic movement. You know, I have many friends who work with authentic movement, which is really letting the movement come out of, be more in the flow. What would that be like to have challenging situations be more like that? Again, with all of these emphases, we need to practice all of these at simple levels, less complex levels, less charged levels, before we bring them into more complex and charged situations. So that's why I'm emphasizing for the next week to choose one or more of these emphases, and to could be just developing more awareness and mindfulness in daily life, could be bringing one or more activities into the realm of mindful practice, the dishes or taking a walk or whatever, then could be practicing with reactivity, sense of pleasant and unpleasant, or inviting this exploration of activity and receptivity, doing and not doing, and see if you can do that at the simplest levels, and see if you can then bring it maybe into relational life where there's no particular issue or problem, right? Because again, the training principle is we want to develop these capacities where they're easier to develop, and then have them ready to bring into more challenging or more complex situations. So that's my invitation for the next week. And then next week, we go into more complexity. You may have some complexity in the next week occur. We will see. Okay, so let me stop there and just invite any thoughts, reflections, questions, anything that occurs to you. Yeah. And why don't we use, I can't see everyone because of the numbers. So if you can use the raised hand function well, that would be good. But I can see 2/3, or I can see almost everyone. So I think if the raised hand function is hard for you, you can physically raise your hand, and maybe Corey, you can you help me with that? So I think actually just raising one's hand can work.
Oh man.
Yeah, please. Yeah, Sherry.
Thanks, Donald. I was thinking about your retreat that I did on the judgmental mind.
Yeah.
And how this kind of links with that. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the challenging the core beliefs that are behind the reactivity.
Yeah, yeah. Some of you have worked with the judgmental mind work. How many of you have done that with me for some period of time? So a number of you. So as you know, in that work, when we do it for a sustained time, including in a 6 or 7 day retreat, but generally when I work with people for more than 5 or 6 sessions, we go beneath the surface in a way which really, in a way, integrates Dharma practice with psychological approaches. And we try to look at some of the organizing principles for the most pervasive expressions of the judgmental mind, which I and a lot of psychologists talk about as limiting beliefs. Limiting belief could be, they usually go back to childhood, many of them do, I'm not okay, or anger is bad, or, you know, my needs won't be met, or if people get close to me, they'll leave, or we're focusing more on the negative ones here. There also, I think, are core beliefs that can be quite positive. And so, yeah, I think that as we notice our five or 10 main forms of reactivity, we may have a sense that there's something beneath the surface that is driving them. You know, I think when we notice more chronic patterns of reactivity, there often is something like a limiting belief that we can locate if we do certain practices. So an example might be one from my own experience that I've mentioned at times. I think that I noticed this really clearly some time ago when I was working with the leader of the organization that I was part of. And I thought that I would become reactive when I thought he's not listening to me. And as I explored that more, I saw that in quite a number of other situations, I would become quite reactive when I thought someone's not listening to me, right? And so this, you know, that, so I could locate in myself some kind of deeper sense that people often don't listen to me, or this a common experience, something like that, or even, you know, people don't listen to me, or sometimes it would take the form of people don't understand me. Anyone have that one? At times? Yeah, that's pretty common, right? So it could be very much linked with that. And that could come out of childhood, maybe being a sensitive child or something like that. And these limiting beliefs linger. And so we can, as we do more investigation of the reactivity, we can sometimes notice something like that. And there are a lot of ways to work with it, which, you know, we did in the judgmental mind retreat. The first step is to really notice the patterns. Then there are different ways of transforming the limiting belief, which generally takes time, because these have been, as it were, lodged in the neural pathways. You know, like mine was lodged in the neural pathways. I mean, it's still there, but even before I was noticing, it was lodged there for 40 plus years, right? So it's like they've been repeated a lot. So does that get it at some, Sherry? Sherry? Yeah, thanks. Please. So we can go deep in a lot of different ways with all of these patterns. I've mentioned some of them. Anyone else? Anyone else? You can just raise your hand. And Liz, looks like you have one, huh? Oh, no, maybe not. You can just raise your physical hand and I or Corey will recognize you. Could be to share something or ask something. Say what's been helpful for you in one of these areas. You know, I think I forgot to do what I often do at the end of a talk, just give some time for quiet reflection. That often brings up something. So we can do that now for 30 seconds or a minute. Is there something that comes to you that would be helpful to share, discuss? Just take 30 seconds, 45 seconds right now. So please, anyone now? Liz, please.
Hi, I love the idea of the dance between receptivity and doing in a conversation.
Yeah.
And I really want to think about that because I'm a doer for whatever reasons we don't want to discuss right now. But I see that. And I like the concept very, very much as a dance of receptivity and doing. So thank you for that concept.
Yeah, thanks, Liz. Yeah, it's really something. Explore that in conversations. You know, it's bring that in the next week. It's, you know, to work with that balance and see if that actually sometimes feels wonderful and sometimes feels awkward because maybe of our habits, right? But it's a beautiful model, and if one can then develop that in the daily flow, what would it be like to have a coworker, a partner, a friend, and you have enough practice together, so you agree when we get into some difficult territory, we'll bring in the sense of collaborative dance. Yeah, and balance the active and the receptive. Yeah, thanks.
Yes, it's a new concept for me, and I really, really love it. Thank you.
Yeah, very much. Thank you. Corey, are you seeing anyone? Are we quiet tonight?
Well, we usually go to 7:30 and we are kind of at the end, so that may be part of it too.
Okay. Has it been 7:30 recently? Because I usually, when I've gone, it's usually till 7:35, 7:40.
We've but generally been 7:30 since we've been on Zoom.
Okay. So time for one more if there is one, and if not, we can come to close. Okay, going once. Going twice. Okay, Katie, please.
Okay, I just a confusion I have. I don't see why receptivity and doing have to be opposites or separated. I don't see why they can't be combined.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to have to talk for a long time because it's almost time to end. But I just don't get that. I understand your doing.
Thank you so much for that, because that's really actually where I go with this, that at a certain level of practice, maybe initially, we want to check, am I too much? They're active and receptive are a pair, and they reflect, you know, different approaches to a particular situation. One can be more active or more receptive. And that's the distinction makes sense in certain ways, you know, like the examples I gave of meditation. That makes some sense. Am I more active in meditation? I'm doing this. I'm naming, you know, I'm naming what's happening. I'm bringing my mind back. There's a certain amount of doing. And am I also receptive, just letting experience come to me? So it makes some sense to look for, you know, where am I on that? And to see if there are patterns where I tend to be more on the active side or more on the receptive side. That makes sense at a certain level. And I think I'm going to end up agreeing with you. In certain contexts, it doesn't make sense, right? And so, you know, one of the directions I go with this theme of doing and not doing is pointing to how it's possible to have one's doing come out of a more profound non-doing or receptivity. You know, and some of the examples I've given are maybe people who are in a really like a flow state. And we think of maybe an artist who's deeply receptive to the creative urges, but there's the doing of painting or the doing of being a musician. There can be an incredible mix of receptivity and a certain kind of doing. That can also occur in meditation. And I'm pointing to that as a further possibility once we've done some of the preliminary checking of, do I have access to the active? Do I have access to the receptive? If I don't have access to one of those, I can't integrate them, right? But then when those are really well developed, then I can invite, let me in my meditation really blend these. Let me in my my teaching right now. Can I blend the active and the receptive in my being with another, in my creative activity, art, music, dance, whatever? There can be a really a beautiful way that these blend into each other. So is that getting some of what you're talking about? Yeah, thank you. Thank you for bringing that out, because I didn't go into much depth on that in my talking tonight. Okay, so let's next week we'll start looking, we'll work with these foundations, and we'll look particularly in turn, we'll bring in material on skillful speech, and particularly working with challenging situations involving interactions, including speech. And so I'll bring in some reflections on polarization, political polarization, polarization of views, different kinds of challenging situations. And so be on the lookout if those occur in your life. Don't go out of your way to create them. I would say be more receptive rather than active in having a mess or a difficulty. Anyway, that joke kind of came through okay, but I hope. But anyway, so that's what we'll explore next week. So let's think of this week as really establishing the foundations. Again, the model is connecting inner practices with outer response as a very crucial way to be with the more complex parts of our lives involving others. So reflect right now, which of these foundational practices for daily life do I want to focus on in the next week? And think of maybe one or two of what I've mentioned or what came to you. And reflect also on what's going to help me remember to work with these.